What is the power of interdisciplinarity in scholarship about media and communication? About this and many other important topics, it's this conversation with Lucia Magis-Weinberg in this new episode of El Café Latinx. What is the experience of being a Latinx or Latin American scholar in the field of communication and media studies? What are the main challenges and opportunities that come with our identities? These are the issues that we'll talk about in El Café Latinx, where some of the leading voices in the field will share their professional experiences. Hola, my name is Pablo Bochkowski. I teach at Northwestern University, where I hold the Hamad bin Khalif Al Thani Chair in Communication. Together with Facundo Suenzo, a doctoral student at Northwestern and executive producer of this podcast, we invite you to discover the journeys of scholars who are at the cutting edge of creating knowledge about Latinx and Latin American communities across the Americas. These are our stories. Estas son nuestras historias. Esas son nuestras historias. Welcome to this new episode of El Café Latinx. I am delighted to have with us today Professor Lucia Magis-Weinberg, who has an MD from UNAM, Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México, and a PhD, and a master's and a PhD in experimental psychology from University College London. She's currently an assistant professor in psychology at the University of Washington in Seattle, where she also directs Interact Lab, the International Adolescent Connection and Technology Laboratory. Before going to UW, in between UCL, University College London, and University of Washington, she was a postdoc at the University of California at Berkeley. She has already an important list of publications on issues at the intersection of communication, technology, adolescence, from a comparative perspective, focusing in particular in or on the Americas. And we are delighted to have her with us today. Lucia, welcome to El Café Latinx.
Thank you so much, Pablo. I'm delighted to be here.
We are thrilled to have you, my friend. So tell us, how did it all begin? That is, how was the start of the journey that led you to become a professor?
Well, I've always, since the start, I've always wanted to be a scientist. Even as a young girl, I remember that very clearly. I was always in this tension between fascinated by understanding the biology of how the human body worked, but also considering all the social aspects of humans and health. So I made the decision to study medicine, knowing that I wanted to do research. In Mexico, I think careers are much more strict. There's less flexibility as an undergrad. So I had to choose early on. I'm now an adolescent expert, and I know that asking adolescents to make such consequential decisions might not be the best decision, making these decisions at 17, 18. So I entered medical school in Mexico, which we do straight after high school. But always really, really fascinated by understanding how our bodies worked. I discovered neuroscience early on by chance in a talk where I heard someone present on emotional memories and using like brain scanners to measure emotional memories. So that really informed a lot of what I wanted to do. And I really liked working with children. But from the research side, not the clinical side. So I decided to go do a master's in cognitive neuroscience with a focus on development, thinking that I was going to work on how children's brains develop. And I was very lucky to land in the laboratory of Professor Sarah Jane Blakemore, who's really a pioneer in the study of adolescence, a period that we don't really think much about. And that opened for me the world of such an important time period that is understudied. So I did my master's and my PhD with more of a focus on brain development in adolescents. And I think it just happened that really social media started to explode when I was doing my PhD. It started to become very popular. So I was really studying how working memory develops, executive control develops. I was doing brain studies of adolescents in the UK. But in all my conversations with parents, with teachers, everyone came back to this idea of social media and what's the impact of social media. So I didn't study that during my PhD, but that's why I wanted to study that for my postdoc, because I realized it's such an important salient context for development for young people today. And curiously, it was through this whirlwind trip that I really realized that I really like doing experiments in the lab and bringing adolescents to the lab, but I missed that contact with young people and also having more of an impact in their well-being. And one interesting thing about adolescents is that they tend to be very healthy. It's the healthiest period of your life. So adolescents actually don't go to healthcare settings very much. So actually working, if you want to work with adolescents, schools are a much better platform to work with them because you won't really see them in the doctor's office to say something. So in the end, I did find my niche really working on topics of mental health, really having an impact, hopefully, on communities and on adolescents' mental health. So starting in medicine, going through neuroscience, and now more in psychology, working with schools.
Very interesting. So let's go back in time. You're in medical school, mm-hmm. Which I'm assuming is a six-year program mm-hmm. at UNAM. Around what time, approximately, what year in the program, you decided that you would go for a master's in experimental and cognitive psychology?
Early on, I knew that I wanted to do postgraduate studies. The topic, I think I defined around my third year, or my fourth year in medical school, through opportunities I have to work in some labs, to learn more about in that developmental science, cognitive neuroscience. I had a life-changing event, which was that I applied my fifth year in medical school. I applied to a summer school in the University of Pennsylvania on computational neuroscience. And that was a wonderful experience for me that really presented me. I met people who were interested in the same topics as I was. It really made me notice some gaps that I had in my training, which was very clinical, how I needed more research training, more statistical training. But I really had a wonderful experience those 3 months in Philadelphia, learning about these tools to study the brain and study eventually development.
And when you were thinking then about postgraduate education, did you consider the US? Did you consider only the UK? Did you consider other countries? Did you consider staying back in Mexico?
Yeah, I think I considered all of them. I applied very widely. I think I was I didn't really know the US system at all, as I do now. So I actually applied to the US and wasn't successful. I applied twice, but I really didn't have a great understanding of how the system worked. I didn't have, I think, comparable research experience to what other applicants had at the time. So I was applying directly to PhDs in the US, but then also masters in Europe, which I think allowed me to bridge this gap in research training that I had. The US doesn't have as many masters, so Europe was better. And I landed in this program in cognitive neuroscience in UCL, and that allowed me to stay there to do my PhD.
And how did you like the experience of being a graduate student in London?
I loved it. I think London is one of my favorite cities. There's so many things happening. It's really metropolitan. You see people from all over the world, which is not an experience that you have often in a country like Mexico. So I really, really enjoyed meeting people from all over the world. It's a wonderful city. It has so much to offer. It has wonderful museums, which in particular, the Science Museum. I had been there as a child, and it's one of my favorite places on earth. I ended up actually doing studies in the Science Museum, so it was a full circle. So I really, really liked it. But but curiously, I hadn't really thought of myself as Mexican as strongly as I started feeling when I was outside Mexico. And eventually that was part of, because all the studies that I did in the UK did not have any cultural components to them. It was a few adolescents from a UK setting, from mostly white families, high income families who would come to the lab. And I didn't ask any questions around culture, around Latin America, but really being away from my country, from my continent, I think really spurred in me the desire to work with Latin American populations, to understand the particularities of our region, to work for young people in our region, which, yeah, happened because I was away.
So how did it feel starting to sort of see yourself as Mexican when you were over there? And how did that sort of inform, if at all, your experience of graduate education?
Very much. I think I was lucky in that it was a very diverse city, very multicultural, so very welcoming of every experience. It's been very interesting to compare my experience of being Mexican in Europe and in the US. I think for better or for worse, the US has a huge percentage of the population that is Latinx, of Mexican origin. Really, there's much more interest in working with Latin America in the US. That's been my perception, where there's grants, there's support, there's interest, there's like your center, there's institutional interest, very formalized in studying the Americas. So I think that's been a very pleasant surprise. In my experience, the work in the UK, their developmental work looks more into India, into Africa, which makes more sense. They have much more geographical proximity.
Okay. And then you are finishing your master's, you're going to your PhD. As you finish your PhD, did you consider going back to Mexico? Did you consider industry? How was the trajectory, the decision to go to Berkeley, right? You mentioned a little bit of that a few minutes ago, but how was your decision making at that time?
Well, there's been a lot of serendipity in my life. And as we were talking about before the podcast, and I had the chance to visit Berkeley during my PhD. So I did a short stay in Berkeley, actually in a different lab to where I ended up in, but that allowed me to meet my supervisor for the postdoc program, which was Dr. Rondal. And like me, he is also an MD, was also straddling this clinical and research work. He has really been a huge advocate for doing translational work on adolescent development. And when I met him during my PhD, we had really wonderful conversations where I thought our interests and our ways of thinking about things were very aligned, partly because we both had that clinical training, but we're now doing research. So that is what opened the opportunity to go to Berkeley to do my postdoc. And it is then that I realized that there was so much more opportunity to work for and with the Americas in the United States.
So in the area of sort of social science and medicine, so that intersection, right? Sometimes you find it in communication, sometimes in anthropology, sometimes in sociology. Psychology is by definition at that intersection, the clinical part of it at least. But that intersection is more commonly inhabited by social scientists who study medicine or who study medical issues, rather than from physicians, right, mm-hmm. who look at social issues. I mean, there are, but you know, statistically it's less common. What is your experience in engaging with, say, communication scholars looking at health, sociologists looking at health and medicine, anthropologists, etc.?
Well, it's been a very wonderful and educating experience for me, because it's really these disciplines that are really talking about the structural components of health. I don't think in medical school, we think about them so much. We think so much about the individual and how to help this particular individual, but really thinking about the systems and structures, about culture, I think I've learned so much from these other disciplines that are really bringing more of the structural views on what makes people healthy or unhealthy, right?
And what do you think in your interactions with scholars from those disciplines, your training as a physician, as somebody who's coming to the sort of behavioral and social sciences from medicine as opposed to the other way around, what is it that you think people like you or your former postdoctoral supervisors can provide to the conversation, can bring to the conversation, but those of us who were trained, well, I was trained in clinical psychology initially. the more traditional path of social scientists looking at health issues can contribute.
I think these are all systems that eventually are acting on biological systems, right? So I think understanding our biologies, understanding our bodies, I've done so much about understanding adolescent brain development. I think that has been transformational of at least our understanding in particular of adolescence. And I think that was only possible and only really highlighted when we started being able to scan adolescent brains. So we understood how much brains change in the first 2 years of life for young children. But now we know that the adolescent brain is drastically transforming in puberty and continues to develop until 24, 25. That actually has allowed us to redefine the span of adolescence, grounded a lot in biology in our brains. So I think in my field of understanding adolescence, always tying it back to biologies, to developing brains, has really been transformational to show adolescence in both the positive as a window of plasticity, of opportunity, and also framing the risks that we do see in this age.
Okay. Now, you went from Berkeley to UW, right? Mm-hmm. From postdoc to tenure track. Many people who do a PhD in the US as part of their training, they attend job talks, this, that. So they're more socialized into how the process works. How was your experience of navigating the job market? Why UW, why psychology? Given that your work is broader than that, right? I mean, you could have gone to other fields.
Thank you. And that's where I feel very lucky. I think I went into many aspects of the process quite blindly, to be frank. And I had a lot of help and support from the networks that I did build in Berkeley with my supervisor, with my colleagues, with a lot of friends. So psychology was the clear space for me. From my postdoc, from all the work that I did in my PhD, those were the types of questions I was asking, the types of papers I was writing. It's the field where I feel the most comfortable and when I do feel the most alignment of my work. But navigating the job market process was a big challenge. I applied in 2020, where it was particularly hard. A lot of universities froze positions. There was much less hiring. So I feel extremely lucky that I got this position at UW.
And, you know, significant component of your work is the comparative aspect. Mm-hmm. And in particular with the Americas, right? Mm-hmm. Or in the Americas. What have you found in your experience are some key challenges of doing this kind of work from the behavioral sciences standpoint? I'm sure if we ask an archaeologist or an anthropologist, we'll get a different story. And what are some of the key opportunities that doing that work opens in US academia?
The first important aspect is that 90% of young people, children, adolescents, are growing up in the majority world in the global south. So I think it's especially important that from developmental psychology or this field, developmental science, we look at the experiences of young people who are growing up in the Americas, in Africa, in Asia, because that's the bulk of the world. And we are not adequately representing the realities of adolescent development if we don't look at those experiences. I think I have experienced the challenges that many other colleagues have reported, our work being perceived, and I've heard that being perceived as too narrow or too focused on a niche population. I think we always need to justify more than other colleagues why we chose to work in Peru or in Mexico, why this population. We need to spend much more time in our papers, describing our context, describing the realities of young people. So that's been a challenge, just from the aspect of publishing papers, finding journals that are open to global work. In psychology, I think that's starting to change, thankfully, but I think we do have an added barrier, even despite the fact that I publish from a U.S. institution, right? I know that colleagues who are trying to publish from the Americas face even more barriers. And one perhaps logistical barrier for doing the type of work that I was doing in my PhD in Mexico, for example, access to brain scanners to these types of devices to do the work. It's simply not possible in many countries in Latin America. These are very expensive machines that very few institutions have. Now I'm starting to see that change. In Mexico, there's some initial developmental studies of adolescent brain development, but just logistically, there's not enough of these research tools to study some of the questions that I was doing during my PhD.
Very interesting. And within the Americas, you know, you mentioned that your talk, some differences, for instance, between Peru and Mexico, even though the number of cases, you know, might have been an issue. But could you comment, you know, because sometimes this work, the comparative work, gets all lumped as sort of the other, as if it was an undifferentiated, right, totality. What is some of your, what are some key aspects of your experience looking at, differences in this case across the Americas? And then how does that also compare to the Latinx experience in the US, right? In terms of what you've seen from your work and from trying to undertake your work?
So I started working in Peru first. As a Mexican, I'm Mexican, but I started working in Peru a bit by serendipity, coincidence, because I joined the lab in Berkeley. And my supervisor at the time got this fantastic opportunity to start this project in Peru. So that was my first. That's how I landed the project in Peru. And it so happened that I spoke Spanish, that I was Latin American. I was comfortable going to those settings. There's a lot of interaction that we had to do with schools, with teachers, with the students and the family. So really understanding the nuances of how to navigate those relationships, which are an important part of research, but not the research per se, was really, really key in my ability to establish these relationships in Peru and start to work with schools. And then it just happened again by serendipity that the schools started expanding in Mexico. So that brought me back to my home country and allowed me to start doing this work. So as I said, there's a lot of comparable things across Mexico and Peru. For example, how much adolescents use WhatsApp. WhatsApp is something that we don't study we don't give it the space it deserves because adolescents in the US don't use WhatsApp. So we just don't understand how young people are using WhatsApp. So that was very, very clear. This idea of sharing devices just because of need, I don't think is as frequent in the global north. So we don't understand what that means. So those were some of the similarities that emerged, the similarities of youth who are more savvy using devices than their parents, and how perhaps we want to ask parents to monitor or to help guide, but sometimes in these settings where I work, parents do not have the technical capacities to do that. I know of 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds who are the ones who are configuring the Wi-Fi to turn it off for the families, right? So I think that's something we don't see as much in the US. As I said in the talk, a lot of what Peruvian youth consume comes through the lens of Mexican YouTubers, Mexican influencers. So that was interesting for me to see. And they're also consuming at the same time a lot of Korean media as well, which was also very surprising. I remember the first time we actually gave out paper questionnaires, this young girl just answered everything in Korean. And I was like, in Peru, I was like, what is happening? Of course, K-pop and all those influences, right? There's been some issues in, not translation, but in me using Mexican words, which in Spanish are fine, and then me going into the classroom in Peru and having some, I'm saying some words I shouldn't have said, and having the kids be very, very surprised that a teacher said those words. That also happened. We've done a lot of translations of the vignettes. Our materials rely so heavily on vignettes, so we really had to understand, or the, like, just stories about what adolescents are doing. And those vignettes came from the United States. For example, the materials in the US have very gender-neutral names on purpose, and very, very international names on purpose because it's for a US context. And our populations in Mexico and Peru did not like that at all. They wanted to know whether Abby was a boy or a girl, and otherwise they couldn't put themselves in the shoes of that character and think it through. We had to adapt the vignettes and the types of activities. And then with Latinx populations, I haven't formally worked with them. It's an interest, a very important interest that I have in my lab now that I'm settled in Seattle, and I do want to start building those relationships. A lot of the students that work in my lab are Latinx and have particular interests in working with families, adolescents that share their experiences. So that's one exciting avenue for my lab.
And speaking of which, how's the process of building your first lab?
It's super exciting. I was very, very lucky because I had built this project in Berkeley that I brought with me. So I actually brought some students with me. So my first PhD student, Daniela Muñoz López, she actually started with me when she was in her second year of her undergrad. So I've seen her grow and develop, and now she's the first PhD student of the lab, which I feel very lucky about. So I think I was well prepared from my experience as a postdoc, and I'm very, very grateful for that. And now really trying to think about the next stages of building my lab is really trying to bring more candidates from Latin America. I've struggled a bit with trying to find those candidates. So if anyone's listening, please reach out. But it's been super exciting to have the opportunity to build this group of people, a group that is mostly either Latinx or Latin American, where we share a lot of cultural experiences and backgrounds, but also in a professional research setting, I think has been really wonderful.
Excellent. And now you are in the psychology department and you're a psychologist by training, but you and I have worked together organizing a pre-conference at the International Communication Association for a number of years. And then before we started recording, were mentioning to me that you started some conversations with people in the information school at the University of Washington. What's your take on interdisciplinarity, do's and don'ts of interdisciplinary work?
So I've changed so much in my career that I've ended up doing a lot of multidisciplinary work, interdisciplinary work. It's really been very educational, very formative for me. to have these conversations, to sit in in discussions from different perspectives has really taught me a lot. For example, all my training has been quantitative, so learning from colleagues who do qualitative work, who are really giving depth and nuance to the findings that we bring from surveys or from questionnaires, has been really, really interesting. I've been very fortunate. I've had wonderful conversations that have really informed my work. I think it's harder when you try to actually put it in publications because you're catering to different outlets. So you're not building a name for yourself in all the disciplines. So I think sometimes you're an outsider. You don't know the method super well. So I published a lot in collaboration. But then different disciplines, we were talking about the beginning. Some disciplines write books, some disciplines write articles, some people just write conference proceedings. So trying to navigate all of that, it has been an interesting learning process. I think you're muted.
Sorry. Navigating part of that is part and parcel of the tenure process, which is different in the US than in the UK, right? How are you dealing with that in your first year on the tenure club?
Well, I feel very, very supported by UW. There's been a very intentional push to hire junior faculty, to hire diverse faculty. I feel very supported. There's a lot of initiatives within the department and across departments to support us. I know different U.S. institutions approach tenure differently. University of Washington, for example, is an institution that wants to keep its associate professors. So we know that, not that it's easier, but there's the expectation and the support for us to thrive and stay. So that has taken a bit of the stress from thinking about the tenure, but I try not to think about it so much. Just try to focus on the work.
Okay. We'll not keep you sort of on this topic then. And then to wrap things up, if you had, magical powers and could be granted one wish about how you would like the study of, issues having to do with intersection of health, media, technology, and, developmental cycles to change, what would you wish for?
I think a more careful treatment of youth, of development, I think is important. And I know different disciplines are in different stages in their understanding of how it's not that all people under 18 are the same, how childhood has its own particular milestones and opportunities and risks, and how adolescence is really distinct, how adolescents have been underserved by our research. For a long time, we don't understand adolescence well enough. We don't talk about adolescence well enough. So really having more nuance and more granularity when we talk about youth, talk about the needs of young people in age-appropriate ways. We know that adolescents have developing capacities. We know that, the needs of different ages vary very widely, and I don't know that we have done a very careful, very systematic mapping of these needs and what young people can contribute, right? So when we ask parents to be monitoring their children's media use, that's very different than when we have expectations for a parent to be monitoring a 17-year-old, right? That is not aligned with what we know of how young people should be developing, how autonomous they need to be by 17, how independent they are. So our recommendations, I think, are always targeted at parents of younger children. So I think we need to do a better job of capturing development. And of course, in a global understanding of development, as I said, really paying attention to adolescents who are growing up outside the US. I think a lot of our definitions of what adolescence is comes from the US in the 1950s, right? So there's a much better understanding we need to have of how people develop around the world.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Lucia, for sharing your knowledge and your experience with us. Thank you for our listeners to staying with us through the end. And I invite everybody to join us for the next episode of El Café Latinx. Thanks again, Lucia. This was great.
Thank you, Pablo.
El Café Latinx is a production of the Center for Latinx Digital Media in the Department of Communication Studies at Northwestern University. I'm Pablo Wojcicki, the host, and I'm joined by executive producer Facundo Swenson.